All right, the marshal's microphone is muted. Does the marshal want to bring us to order?
I do indeed. Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
The marshal should, yeah, there we go. Reset the clock. Thank you. Good morning to counsel in this case. This panel, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is July 8th, 2020. This panel of the court has three cases set for oral argument today. This is the first case of the three. The case is number A19-2045, Reimringer versus Anderson. It appears we have everyone present. I'll just make an explanatory note. I know that there was a request for an additional person to participate. Our court, in attempting to make the WebEx work as smoothly as possible for those necessary, we have made a court-wide policy for all cases of limiting the participants to only those who need to speak. And so I apologize to counsel if you, that your co-counsel was not permitted to join. But that's been our policy across the board, and we've applied it fairly strictly. We're working on ways to provide more public access to the live arguments, and that hopefully will be coming in the future. In the meantime, other people may listen to the audio recording on our internet within a day or two of the argument. I'd like to just first do a sound check with the two judges on the panel, Judge Reyes and Judge Frisch. Are you both able to hear me, and want to make sure we can hear you as well?
Yes, thank you.
Yep, I can hear you.
Very good. And then Respondents' Counsel, can you see and hear everyone?
I can, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you very much. Then Appellants' Counsel, assuming you can see and hear everybody, then you may begin. As you know, you have 15 minutes for your initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I can see and hear everybody. May it please the Court. My name is Dean Treffs, attorney for Appellant Aaron Reimringer. Over 100 years ago, the Minnesota Supreme Court declared, "The law does not permit the owner of land, be his title ever so good, to be the judge of his own rights with respect to his possession adversely held." Instead, the courts have consistently held that the law requires landowners to go through the courts to retake possession. Respondent made himself judge of his own rights, server of his own limited process, and sheriff enforcing his own judgment. In fact, the facts here present the exact scenario that Minnesota courts have sought to prevent for over this century: a landlord ousting a tenant and his family using threats of violence, in this case in the middle of the night and without warning. Statute 504B.231 is the enforcement mechanism for requiring landlords to go through the court. Landlords have a very summary eviction proceeding in Minnesota. Cases can be heard in as little as 2 or 3 weeks, and there is very little opportunity for delay. However, respondent refused to do even this, which is why he violated 504B.231 and is liable for treble of appellant's damages.
Now, Mr. Treffs, the section 0.231A allows damages I'm paraphrasing a bit, if a landlord in bad faith removes, excludes, or forcibly keeps out a tenant, correct?
Correct.
So that statute, and am I correct, that's the only relief you're seeking at this stage of the case?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that particular statute uses the word tenant, not the word residential tenant. Why are you concerned about whether your client has satisfied the definition of residential tenant, which is used in 375?
Because that's been the definition used by all prior cases, I believe, and that there is no definition of just tenant other than kind of more near case law, and that if he is a residential tenant, then he is for sure a tenant.
Which cases apply the definition of residential tenant to the word tenant in 231?
So in Cucharella v. Driggs, not the one that has been coming up as much in the Supreme Court, but the case in the Court of Appeals, it kicked, it remanded down a question of whether 231 damages were should have been looked at by the district court while discussing the 504B.001 residential tenant definition.
My recollection is that our court discussed the definition of residential tenant for purposes of the 375 repossession, a recovery claim, but did not get into any issues concerning the 231 damages claim.
My understanding was that it remanded for that issue because the district court kind of summarily did not right. consider that issue.
But if we had concluded that, because the Court of Appeals concluded that the plaintiff was not a residential tenant, I mean, if we thought it was appropriate to transfer the definition of residential tenant to tenant, it seems to me we probably would have dismissed the 231, or we would not have remanded the 231 claim for further consideration.
Well, and that goes to that the Court of Appeals believed that a tenant is broader than a residential tenant, so that leads to the conclusion that if one is a residential tenant, one is also a tenant. So I think that proposition is one can be a tenant but not a residential tenant. I think the reverse can be inferred there. In this case,
I'd like to move to the issue of bad faith. The district court, because that's a required element of your damages claim, the district court made a finding that there was not bad faith. Would you agree that our standard of review for that is clearly erroneous?
I would not, Your Honor. The facts here are undisputed. The respondent had a chance to contest any of the facts that happened during that night. He declined to do so. I've heard no objection to the testimony that was had, and there's been no contest of those. And when the facts are undisputed, their misapplication is an error at law. So I believe it is a de novo standard, and the standard for bad faith should have been the general one for contracts is whether the respondent refused to fulfill a duty not prompted by an honest mistake. Here we have respondent refusing to talk to a law enforcement officer telling him that what he was doing was illegal. So this was clearly not an honest mistake. He was trying to avoid process that was due.
But I understand that the historical facts there may be few disputes about the historical facts, but isn't the question of bad faith also a fact, an ultimate fact that a district court must find based upon all the evidence?
I believe but the district court must also apply the facts that it finds to the law. And I believe that application of the facts that are in the record and are undisputed, that is the error, making it an error of law. And again, the undisputed facts were, and this was in the complaint as well, so they had an opportunity, what were the threats of violence coming in the middle of the night and the chains preventing them from reentering. And the district court erred both in applying them generally, but in what facts it looked at. It looked at mitigation after the fact, which 504B.231 talks about removing, excluding, and forcibly keeping out, not facts after the fact.
So I'm a little confused here, counsel, because you argue both in your primary brief and also in your reply brief that it's only the standard of review is de novo, and yet I hear you in what I read in your brief. It sounds like you're contesting the facts that the district court found and rely on what you argue are either uncontested facts or irrelevant ones. And the irrelevant ones, I'm not so sure we can say that what the district court found, the findings of fact by the district court were irrelevant. And so that's my first comment. My second is, what do you mean by irrelevant irrelevant ones. What are the irrelevant facts that the district court found?
I wouldn't say they were, well, they focused on when making the decision that it wasn't in bad faith, that the actions after the actual exclusion and removal. The 504B.231 talks about the removal and exclusion. So finding the lack of bad faith in the actions afterwards, which I'm not contesting any of the facts that the district court found. I don't believe any of the facts of that night are necessarily contested here. I'm merely asserting that the district court applied the wrong facts when deciding whether bad faith was applicable here, because it found it's the respondent's actions after he removed, excluded, and forcibly kept out Mr. Reimreger. Whereas 504B.231 requires the bad faith to happen during the removal, exclusion, or forcible keeping out.
But isn't the exclusion and the forcibly keeping out an ongoing act?
It is. And there were several instances. But regardless, the hang for a couple nights at the hotel does not affect whether the actions of removing, excluding, and forcibly keeping out. That is a mitigation, but it is not, it doesn't affect the bad faith of the actual actions that the statute requires us to look at.
Why isn't that part and parcel of it? Because rather than just forcing somebody out and saying, hey, you know what, there's the street, make yourself comfortable on the street right outside, but you're not getting into this house, finding accommodations for that, for the people and for the family. Why isn't that part of that analysis, as Judge Frisch noted? That seems to be part of the ongoing activities that are occurring here.
Well, because that it goes back to what the error in general in this section was the standard. The standard is not whether respondent wished Mr. Reimreger to be homeless or wished him ill. The standard is, did he refuse to fulfill a duty that wasn't prompted by an honest mistake? He had a duty to take him to court. That has been a long time duty in Minnesota landlord-tenant law. He failed to do that, and it wasn't prompted by an honest mistake, because if it was, he wouldn't have refused to talk to law enforcement about the issue.
So Mr. Anderson testified, I'm looking at page 84 of the transcript, that he provided Mr. Reimreger with his bank account so that Mr. Reimreger could wire money to it. He said that Mr. Reimreger asked me to do that, that he paid for the two nights of the hotel, I think, to give him time to do that. I think that the third or fourth night of the hotel was perhaps just charged by the hotel when Mr. Reimreger stayed longer. But it seems like what he was trying to allow for was trying to allow for payment of the security deposit and the rent that was due so that Mr. Reimreger could stay in there. It seems like he was keeping that possibility open at some expense to himself. I mean, I don't understand why that's not something the district court could rely on to find a lack of bad faith.
Because it's, again, about him failing to fulfill a duty. There was kind of this quasi informal redemption, which is allowed in the statutory scheme that he was required to go through. He refused to fulfill a duty, not based on honest mistake. His duty was to go through the courts. His duty was not to show up in the middle of the night and force them out. So the bad faith is based on that refusal to fulfill that duty, not his animosity or lack thereof towards Mr. Reimreger, not his willingness to kind of informally settle these things. It was about his refusal to fulfill the duty to go through the courts. And the courts have long required this. I believe the language in Bird v. Wiley is very kind of illustrative of this, is they don't want these confrontations between landlords and tenants because they can get violent. And so the courts have been very clear about, no, we don't want these informal mechanisms where they're not controlled, they're not supervised by the courts. We want them to go through the courts so we can make sure that these kind of flashpoints where people will potentially have violence don't happen. And so, again, his kind of how he felt in his heart towards Mr. Reimringer is irrelevant here. What's relevant is that he refused to fulfill a duty, and that was not prompted by an honest mistake.
I think the definition you provided in your brief also refers to an ulterior motive. So what is his ulterior motive here?
Well, and again, the uncontested testimony was that he was under the mistaken belief that if a tenant occupies a property during the months of, I believe it was October through April, kind of this belief of a cold weather rule where they can't be evicted. So he, and this squares with his actions, wanted them out so they couldn't just sit there all winter based on a misunderstanding of what I believe is a utility shutoff rule, cold weather rule. So he had an ulterior motive in denying them process that he thought was due. And in doing that, he denied them the process they actually were due.
I'm wondering if you could turn, I realize you only have about a minute left, but I was wondering if you could turn to the issue of the lack of any payment made and whether that affected the fact that the district court's interpretation of there being no valid lease agreement at all because there was no payment made.
Yes, and that goes back to what we talked about earlier with the residential tenants. The operative language is someone occupying a dwelling under a lease or contract that requires payment of money or exchange of services. Here, everyone agrees that the lease in evidence is the lease that everybody signed, and it requires payment of money. So all of the criteria for whether he was a tenant existed because he occupied, it was under a lease, and that lease required payment of money or, in this case, and exchange of services. So because
those were required to be paid in advance, correct?
That is, no, in the lease, and I believe in my reply brief, I included a picture of the section, that explicitly says a receipt. That is a receipt. It's incorrect in that lease, but it's acknowledging money that was paid, even if in this case it wasn't. And that would be, saying that requires, and the lease is conditioned on it. If I may finish this thought, I know I'm out of time.
Please do.
Merely, that would be reading a condition precedent into a contract where it does not exist. And in the Meraza construction case, the court explicitly held that condition precedents will not be found absent of unequivocal language. And that is unequivocally not a condition precedent. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal, as I mentioned earlier. Ms. Esch, on behalf of respondent, you may proceed. I think your microphone is muted. You need to unmute.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jane Esch, and I represent the respondent, Bart Anderson. I'm happy to answer any questions that any of you have regarding our briefs. I think it's well set out in the briefs. I do want to address just a few of the points that your honors brought up, and of course the appellant responded to. I do believe statute 504B.231, so it applies to the exclusion of a tenant from residential premises. So it doesn't say just a tenant from the premises, which would imply that it's broader. It could be a residential or commercial tenant in that sense. It is just for exclusion of a tenant from residential premises. So I think in that case, you know, the definition of a residential tenant, and of course the requirements to be a residential tenant, do apply as kind of a threshold matter in order to bring an action for damages under 504B.231. Of course, in this case, the district court found, and I believe it's consistent with all the case law and consistent with her evaluation of the facts and the witness's credibility, and she found that the appellant did not meet the definition of a residential tenant for both his action under 504B.375 and then also for his action under 504B.231. In any case, of course, as your honors know, 504B.231 does require a finding of bad faith on behalf of the excluder. And of course, bad faith is a factual determination. And here there should be deference given to the district court's findings of the facts. I know Mr. Treff said that there's no dispute as to the facts. I think there is a dispute as to the facts, especially on this night, you know, and what was said, what wasn't said, whether or not there was a law enforcement officer on a phone. There is clearly a dispute of facts. And I think we need to give deference to the district court's findings of the facts and weighing of the credibility of the witnesses. Here she did just that. That's what her order does. And she did find that the respondent was overall more credible than the appellant.
Is there any precedential authority for the principle that bad faith is a question of fact and one to which we apply a clear error standard of review?
So I do know, and I think the appellant admitted in his brief as well, that there's not a clear definition of bad faith, legal definition of bad faith for purposes of 504B.231. I think bad faith overall, it does require a finding of facts because it's based on, you know, whether a person's actions in a certain situation were not acceptable in that situation. So I do think that is inherently a factual determination in that sense. And then another comment that Mr. Treffs brought up is, I know he's contesting that the district court relied on the respondent's actions, what Mr. Treffs called after the fact. So this, you know, the respondent, and it's uncontested by the appellant, the respondent paid for 3 nights for the appellant and his family to stay in a hotel while the respondent opened another bank account, wanted to leave this option open for the appellant to come back and, you know, regain premises or the premises if he fulfilled his obligation and his consideration under the contract. And so I don't believe that that is a separate or remedial act. It's all one continuous act. It all happened in one night. It's not like the respondent changed the locks and said, have at it, you can have the street for a night, and then decided to get him a hotel. It all happened at once, and I think the evidence is clear. The appellant's girlfriend was home when the respondent first entered the premises, and they had a discussion. And then the appellant himself came home and they had further discussion. And then the respondent, of course, got them a hotel to stay in that night and for 2 nights following that. And that's markedly different from some of the other cases that we have where bad faith was found. So in Bass versus Equity Residential Holdings, there the landlord, of course, the tenant had paid rent and paid the security deposit for a number of months and then fell behind on payments. And in that case, the landlord picked the locks, changed the locks while the tenant was out, and then threw all of her belongings into a flooded dumpster, which destroyed all of her belongings. And here, of course, the appellant's girlfriend was home, and then the appellant himself came home. There was no changing of locks when people were out. And there, here, the respondent also rented a locked storage container and put the appellant's belongings in that and told the appellant where he could find the key to regain his possessions. So that's distinguishable from Bass in that aspect. And then I think finally, a quick comment on this aspect of consideration and whether 504B.001 subdivision 12, which is the definition of a residential tenant, actually requires consideration, or As Mr. Treffs, I understand he argues it's simply an agreement, and some part of that agreement requires payment of money or exchange of services. But according to Mr. Treffs, there doesn't actually have to be payment of money or exchange of services. And I think Mr. Treffs' interpretation
I'm not so sure I read his interpretation of it like that. I thought his argument was that there's no condition precedent. The payment doesn't necessarily have to be made beforehand. That's how I interpreted his argument. But feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. But I thought that's how it was framed.
Yep, and I think that was part of it. And obviously, Mr. Treffs can speak for himself on that. I do think so. Here, the lease agreement. You will see, and as Mr. Treffs put in his reply brief, that there's a section, and it does say receipt at the signing, and then it says advance payment of first month's rent, advance payment of last month's rent, and the security deposit. And then you can go to paragraph 2 of the lease, and it does require advance payment of every month's rent. And so there are multiple provisions to the lease that require this advance payment. And I understand appellant, it's in the record, and the district court found that the appellant understood that to be actually requiring advance payment. And so the appellant understood, and he admitted at the evidentiary hearing that he didn't provide any payment. So not even partial payment, not $1, not 1 cent. And he understood that had to be advanced payment. And so there is a condition precedent in this lease for the advance payment. And I think that's part and parcel. Perhaps there could be an agreement where there didn't have to be advance payment, but here the parties understood and the written agreement reflects that this had to be an advance payment. And in terms of the exchange for services, there was testimony by the appellant that he claimed to have exchanged some services in lieu of reducing some of the rent. Of course, the lease agreement says, and the appellant admitted, and he understood that reduction for exchange of carpentry work can only be applied to some of the rent. So up to 9 months of the rent, the other 3 months have to be paid in full. And further, appellant admitted, the district court found that all carpentry work needs to be prior approved. And here the district court found that the appellant did not credibly testify as to any prior approved carpentry work or the nature of the work. And the district court further found, and there was evidence in the record, that the appellant had actually damaged the property and not improved it in any manner. So I do think both 504B.001, that does require, it doesn't obviate consideration or doesn't obviate just a simple agreement to in the future pay or exchange services in order to be a residential tenant. And the way I understand Cottrella versus Driggs is that the payment of money was essential to the court's finding that Cottrella was a residential tenant. So of course there was an oral agreement between Cottrella versus Driggs to rent the premises. And Driggs said, yep, I agree to rent this to you. I need first month's rent and I need the security deposit. And Cottrella paid him that, Driggs accepted the payment, and then refused to deliver actual physical possession of the premises. I think in that case, there's no question that Driggs was enriched in that sense where he accepted payment but didn't fulfill his obligation to deliver the premises. And so the question there, of course, is like, yeah, you can bring an action for unjust enrichment and recover your payment, but can Cottrella also, without actually having physically occupied the premises, bring an action for unlawful exclusion and get specific for performance to regain the premises. And so in that sense, I think the payment was more than just dicta. I understand the appellant says it's dicta, but I think the payment of money was more than dicta in that court's decision. It was essential.
Ms. Ash, if we set the Cocciarella opinion aside and look only at the statute, would you make the same argument?
I would, in consideration that lease agreements are general contracts. General principles of contract law govern these agreements. And here, it's not just that there's an agreement that requires some sort of payment of money or exchange of services, but that there is actual payment of money or exchange of services, at least at the outset of that agreement, in order to first, you know, in order for the landlord to have any obligation to deliver the premises to the tenant in the first place.
I think we would probably agree that in most cases, if somebody is occupying a dwelling under a lease, and if the lease requires the payment of money, the person probably has already paid the money. I mean, I think it's a rather unusual case we have here where somebody might have been occupying under a lease, the lease required the payment of money, but the payment hadn't actually yet been made. And that leads to this tricky issue. I guess I'll, speaking only for myself, I'll say that I think the statute alone indicates that the requirement of a payment of money refers more to the lease rather than to the occupancy. But Cocciarella might make it a little bit confusing. But anyway, I'll leave it at that unless you have any response to what I said.
Yeah, and I would add too that here the district court found, and there's ample evidence in the record, that the appellant gained occupation of the premises, not through consent or authorization of the respondent, but through getting the keys from the former tenant. And the respondent didn't even know that he had moved in until a few weeks later.
Am I correct? He discovered the occupancy after, you know, a days or weeks after it had occurred, but also days or a week or two before he kicked them out on September 30, right? Sometime in the middle of the month?
That is correct, yes.
And when he first discovered it, he didn't immediately eject them. He allowed them to remain for a period of time, right?
I think, if I may continue this thought.
Please do. Yep, feel free to answer the question fully.
Yes, I think this was the same, you know, the appellant had continued to promise that he would pay immediately. And so the respondent had expected that he would get payment very soon after he discovered that they were in the premises. And that, of course, did not occur. In sum, we would just ask you to respectfully affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Esch. Counsel for appellant, you may, you have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to first point out on the note you ended with that respondent, you're correct, respondent did not kick them out as soon as he found out. And what he did do was he did what landlords do. He demanded rent. And I think that shows it was treating them like a tenant. And I think overall, this whole case is about a kind of misunderstanding between breaches of a lease and formation of a lease. And I think you can look at the district court's decision and showing that they fundamentally misunderstood that distinction. Because there is even a section in paragraph 40, they found that the lease was invalid due to material breaches. But when there are material breaches, a landlord is required to go to court to address them. And that is the issue here. I would like to point out that for the contract to have, for the lease to have had a condition present that must be unequivocal, and that's Mrazek Construction laid that out. In fact, this court, in a decision released just barely over a month ago in Truyen v. Talon OP, that's A19-1541 and A19-1654, applied that same logic to yet another form of contract, in that case, a consulting contract. So the precedent has been clear that the court will not read a condition precedent when none exists. All of the think the receipt is very clearly a receipt and not a condition precedent. There's no language.
Let me stop you there, if I might. Yes. You refer to it as a receipt. And when you say a receipt, I think of something that is basically handed to somebody. But when I look at the Exhibit 1, the standard lease agreement, that box that you cut and pasted out of it, that is part of the residential lease agreement itself. So that seems to incorporate those terms explicitly into the lease, including the fact that you have to have the first month's rent, last month's rent, and security deposit paid in advance. And as Ms. Esch pointed out, Section 2 also seems to support the idea that any rent needs to be paid in advance. So if that was not paid in advance, why is it that the district court erred by looking at that and saying there's no contract that was formed because that condition precedent had never been satisfied in the first instance?
Because that, again, the court has been clear in the past saying that they will not read a condition precedent when there's not conditional language.
But why isn't that conditional language there? It seems pretty clear that when it says paid in advance, in your reply brief, you say there's no language of in advance, but it's right there, right on the first page of the lease agreement itself.
When the courts lay out conditional language means before this is the language indicating that the lease does not become valid until that is paid. That is an acknowledgement, an incorrect acknowledgement, but an acknowledgement of money that was supposed to, that was transferred at that time, which we know now did not happen, but it doesn't ever say that this lease does not become valid prior to that happening. And at no point does the lease say this lease is conditioned upon, to be in effect, it is conditioned upon these amounts. These are
terms. It doesn't use that magic language of this lease is conditioned upon it, but a reasonable interpretation of that seems to be that if it says paid in advance, you need to pay it in advance in order for the tenant to be able to actually reside in the land.
And I would again turn your honor to Meraza Construction, where the court said that without unequivocal language conditioning the enforceability of a contract on a condition, the court will not read that into it. And again, there is nothing here saying that that has to happen. There are many terms. Paragraph 2 is a term, and the solution to that is not not a huge burden. It is merely they have to go to eviction court. If terms are breached, they have to go to court. We're not saying that we're not claiming that terms were not breached. We're merely saying that they have to use the process so we don't have these dangerous situations as the courts have required. Thank you. Your Honor, you're muted.
Thank you. Thank you to counsel for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days.